And if you go back in history and you analyze empires in decline, it's very similar to what's happening today, where the American empire, it's going to cannibalize its allies. I mean, it can't beat Russia on the battlefield, but what it will do is basically steal resources from its allies and force its allies to fight wars that it can't possibly win. Once the Europeans start to introduce the giraffe, it's going to cause massive discontent throughout the continent. A lot of these regimes, you look at what's happening in Britain, you look at what's happening in Germany, in France, right? I mean, like, if you've been just following the news about what's happening in Germany, like these seven ADF AFD candidates who've been mysteriously dead. I mean, they've mysteriously died for different reasons. So there's a lot of suspicious things going on throughout Europe. But I think that in the second round, and Trudy Parsi says this, the Iranians will unleash their full might. And the Iranians have the capacity to destroy Tel Aviv. They really do. So I think that in the second round, the Americans will be much more forceful in the response. I think that this conflict will escalate very rapidly in the Middle East, starting in a couple months. Yeah.
You're watching Capital Cosm. My name is Danny. It is September 17th, 2025, and my guest today is Professor Jiang from the Predictive History YouTube channel that's blowing up right now. I recently came to discover Professor Jiang a couple of weeks ago, actually, and the first video I watched, it just led me down a rabbit hole throughout the rest of his content, and I said to myself, I need to get this guy in front of my audience. Like, this is someone that you guys need to listen and watch, guys. So, Professor Jiang, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for inviting me, Danny.
Yeah, let's just go ahead and kick things off, Professor. Where do you see things going from here with respect to Ukraine and Russia, Iran and Israel, even potentially the South China Sea with Taiwan and the U.S. and China? I'll let you start in any of those theaters. We can kind of piggyback off of them as we go forward.
Yeah, so I think that for the next 2 years, we're heading into major conflicts around the globe. So the conflict will definitely heat up between NATO and Russia. Ukraine, the military, it's basically been exhausted after many years of fighting the Russians. Apparently, there are rumors that the Ukrainians have lost 1 million men in the fight. So the war of attrition has really taken its toll on Ukraine. But NATO will not give up the fight. We're seeing that Poland has already invoked Article 4, which is and that allows Poland then to invoke Article 5, and then NATO will come to the defense of Poland. So we're seeing a major ramp up of the war in Ukraine. NATO will start to move forces into Ukraine to shore up Ukrainian defenses. Russia right now will continue its strategy of Russia will continue its war of attrition, which is working really well for itself. At the same time, I think that we will see major escalation in the conflict in the Middle East between Israel and Iran. Israel has declared a full-scale offensive in Gaza City. And eventually, I think Israel will strike at Iran, because as many analysts say, and you know, I'm not alone in this, but many geopolitical analysts believe that Israel has a really short time frame to settle the conflict via Iran. It really wants to overturn the regime in Iran, and it sees a golden opportunity right now. But for this to happen, Israel needs to draw the United States into the conflict. And I think that eventually the United States will come into this conflict on the side of Israel. So we will see two major conflicts in the next year emerge. So this war in Ukraine will escalate. NATO will start sending in forces. And we will also see eventually a ground invasion, a U.S. ground invasion of Iran. And this will eventually draw in the entire world, because the Middle East, Anatolia, they're really the nexus of global trade. It's impossible to get anywhere in the world without going through the Middle East. Most of the world's oil supply is in the Middle East. East Asia draws most of its oil from the Middle East. So I think that these are the two major conflicts we should be expecting next year or two. At the same time, there's worry about a conflict in the South China Sea. There's a worry that China will take advantage of U.S. overextension, the United States. If it forces a ground invasion of Iran, it'll be overextended, and this will present China with the perfect opportunity to encircle and threaten Taiwan. I think that's very unlikely. I live and work in Beijing, and no one talks about Taiwan. And if you go to Taiwan, no one talks about China. So I think a conflict arising in the South China Sea between China and Taiwan is very unlikely. The wild card in Southeast Asia is actually North Korea, because North Korea is sending troops to Ukraine. North Korea sees an opportunity to maybe overturn the apple cart, as they like to say. China is very much a status quo power. It benefits from the global trade regime. It does not want to upset the United States. I think that the major surprise is when within the next 6 months to a year, we'll see a major rapprochement between China and the United States. This will benefit both China and the United States. China needs access to the American market. The United States needs cheap Chinese labor. And it basically needs to stabilize the situation in Southeast Asia. In fact, there's rumors that the Pentagon is about to release a new paper, National Defense Priorities, that makes this argument, that argues that we're right now overextended, and we need to focus more resources internally and sort of come to peace with China. So this is how I see the world developing next year or two.
Interesting. Don't you also anticipate them holding off on China as well, because they, the United States, that is, because they do see themselves involved in a major crisis and war in the Middle East? Is that why we may see like a rapprochement, but it may be short-lived? Do you see this rapprochement as long-lasting, or just to give the United States enough time to deal what it has to do, to deal with Iran, and then move on to the final boss, which is China?
Yeah. So this is, as you mentioned, this is what's called a sequencing strategy in Washington D.C. Let's deal with Iran, then let's move on to China, then let's go back to deal with Russia, and that's the strategy moving forward. I see the world in a different way. I don't think there's actually a real geopolitical conflict between China and the United States. I actually see them as symbiotic. And this trade war between China and the United States, it's really a negotiation. It's about leverage, because the United States wants more access to the Chinese financial system. It basically wants to create a symbiotic relationship between the renminbi and the US dollar, because right now the US dollar is under threat. So basically, it wants China to shore up the U.S. dollar, and China is reluctant to do that because the United States right now has $37 trillion in debt. So I think that right now, for the past 5-10 years, there's been very high level, intense negotiations going on between China and the United States. But eventually, I think that the conflict will be settled and they'll come to an arrangement. I mean, the reality, and it's really important, is that right now, the military that's defending you, Chinese exports, okay? When Chinese ships go overseas, when they go off to South America, when they go to Europe, it's not the Chinese Navy that's protecting these ships. China doesn't have a blue water Navy. It's the U.S. Navy that's protecting these Chinese ships. So we need to understand the underlying fundamental structure of the U.S.-China economic relationship. And then once we understand that, we understand that it will be inevitable that they will come to a compromise together.
Will they come under a compromise under a unipolar banner as we have today, or will it be more so a multipolar banner?
Yeah, so the Americans are interested in maintaining the hegemony of the U.S. dollar. China wants to maintain its sovereignty. What China is afraid of is a repeat of the 1997 Asian financial crisis, when the Southeast Asian economies, they were tied to the US dollar, so that created tremendous problems in their own financial system. So China needs to maintain its own sovereignty. But China doesn't really think geopolitically. It's not really concerned with who's the boss. China just wants to be left alone. So China's not really interested in competing with the United States for global dominance.
I see. Now let's go back to the other two theaters of war that we mentioned earlier on that seem a lot more urgent than the South China Sea and the Korean Peninsula. And that is the Ukraine and Middle East front. Let's go ahead and go back to the Ukraine front. You mentioned Poland enacting Article 4. However, this is not gaining much traction, if at all, in the news headlines. It's understandable. You just had an assassination of a major political commentator here in the United States in Charlie Kirk last week. But nonetheless, I mean, it just seems like a major event, but nothing appears to be on the radar screen of the news media. And then you also have North Korea sending in troops into Ukraine as well. There wasn't a deal that was reached between the meeting between President Trump and President Putin. And there doesn't appear to be any solution on the table. And at the same time, you're seeing the bond market, the debt markets in Europe completely go down the toilet. From what I'm hearing from my friends who have connections, very wealthy connections in Europe, I mean, the wealthy are leaving Europe en masse and going to places like Dubai and Singapore and elsewhere. So how do you see things playing out in Europe? Because it appears that they need this war, do they not? All sorts of internal conflicts are arising, and it seems that war is the only, I don't want to say it's an answer, but in their mind, it may be an answer.
Yeah, so I agree with your assessment. First of all, there are these internal divisions within Europe caused by economic malaise, caused by mass immigration, and war is a way to distract the population, right? So you have basically the possibility of a major civil war erupting in Britain. You have like these mass million men marches against immigration in Britain, and it's a rebuke of the policy of the elite in Britain. And so you need a war to distract the masses. I would also say that for the past 4 years, even though we don't really talk about it, Britain and the Europeans have invested a great deal of resources into this Ukraine war. Now you have sunk cost fallacy. You know, you put in billions of dollars into this war, and the possibility that Russia will win this war and all this money will be evaporated, and you will not have access to Ukrainian rare earth minerals. You won't have access to all their wealth. That I don't think the European elite can stomach. They basically pot committed. You know, they've pushed all in this war in Ukraine, and I don't think they're going to give it up easily. The other thing is, we don't really talk about this, but Putin has already said, look, we're not really fighting the Ukrainians in Ukraine. We're fighting NATO in Ukraine. We're not really fighting NATO troops. We're fighting NATO weaponry. We're fighting NATO financing. We're fighting NATO intelligence, right? So these missiles that hit Russian targets, blowing a bridge in Crimea, it's NATO targeting, because the Ukrainians won't have the expertise, the training to actually operate these weapon systems. It has to be NATO technology, NATO expertise, NATO financing. So, I mean, NATO is already in this war already. Now it's a question of, like, will they actually send ground troops? Also, like, special forces are already in Ukraine. So, I mean, it's not a big leap for NATO to send in ground troops.
Yeah, and there was this leaked memo a week ago or so saying that France was preparing its hospitals to get ready for mass casualties because they anticipate some ground. They anticipate the war to come to Europe effectively, or European troops to be sent over to Ukraine. And in either case, this thing is escalating. And they were saying as early as 2026. So in September today, maybe in a few months' time.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think the European leadership has dug a hole for themselves, and they're not very creative. They don't know how to get out of this mess. So they'll just dig deeper. And so I think the next logical step would be to send in ground troops to shore up your Ukrainian defenses. Because if you follow, if you've been following the front lines, I mean, the Ukrainian front lines have basically collapsed. It's really, but like the Russians are very methodical. They're very slow. They use artillery warfare. So they're very slow because they're trying to limit casualties, right? But I mean, if they wanted to, they could push across the European front, the Ukrainian front right now, and it'll all collapse. We're seeing this in Provost. We're seeing this in quite a few places. The other thing that we're seeing is high morale among Russian soldiers. They're very creative. They're very energetic. They feel as though they have this holy crusade for civilization against you know, the Europeans. On the other hand, the Ukrainians, I mean, like the desertion rate is just, I mean, it's very high. I mean, like they're not motivated to fight anymore. So the Ukrainian war is basically lost. And that's why NATO has no choice but to come in as a backup.
And in terms of NATO, does that include the United States? Because it appears right now that the United States is going to just let Europe handle it on its own. And if that is indeed the case, does Europe have the capacity to get in on a wartime footing in the next 3 months or so, like that memo said, in 2026?
Yeah. So I think what we're seeing at the end of the day is a decline, an empire in decline. And when an empire is in decline, it's desperate, and its policies are counterproductive. You can make the argument that the intention of the United States is to cannibalize its allies. What I mean by that is that it wants its allies to purchase expensive U.S. weapons. It wants its allies to fight this pointless war in Ukraine that it can't possibly win. But we've seen this throughout history, you know, like predictive history. Like the argument that I make is that history rhymes. And if you go back in history and you analyze empires in decline, it's very similar to what's happening today, where the American empire, it's going to cannibalize its allies. I mean, it can't beat Russia on the battlefield, but what it will do is basically steal resources from its allies and force its allies to fight wars that it can't possibly win.
And isn't the average lifetime of an empire like so 250 some odd years or so, something like that? Isn't that the official lifespan? And if that is indeed the case, if that is the average lifespan of an empire, it appears we've hit that lifespan,
right? And I mean, like but the thing is, like, these collapses happen really quickly. They happen almost overnight. So maybe 10 years ago, it was almost as though U.S. hegemony, it was unimaginable that it could be challenged. But nowadays, it feels as though it's really a house of cards. I mean, I don't see the United States being able to fight an effective war against a peer adversary. I think that eventually the United States will send in ground troops against Iran, and I think it'll be a disaster. I mean, like, and as an example, just look at the parade that Trump organized, right? I mean, and you compare that with the Chinese parade that happened, a couple weeks earlier here in Beijing. So I don't think the U.S. military is ready for full-scale war. The U.S. military, for the past 20 years, it's been heavily reliant on special forces and aerial bombardment. It doesn't really know how to make the sacrifices necessary to win a ground war.
I see. And given all of this, before we move on to Iran here, let's kind of put a bow on Russia, Ukraine. Given all of this, what do you see as the end game in Europe? Do you see Russia winning this war? What does that look like? Does this war extend beyond the borders of Ukraine, or will it stay confined within Ukraine? And that's kind of like a agreed upon battlefield for all of Europe is Ukraine.
Right. So my theory is the Odessa trap, and the idea is that maybe for the next year or two, you'll see a lot of flare ups throughout Europe. But eventually, all this conflict will converge in Odessa. What happened is that Russia will encircle Odessa, and NATO needs to defend Odessa, because once Putin takes Odessa, the war is over, right? Because Odessa is the last military strategic objective of Russia. Once Russia has Odessa, then it controls the coastline. It controls eastern Ukraine, which is the agricultural industrial heartland of Ukraine. Western Ukraine would just be a rump state. The Europeans would need to basically put everyone in Western Ukraine on welfare. So Odessa really is the strategic hub of Ukraine. And so Russia will encircle Ukraine, Odessa, and Europeans will be forced to support Odessa. But once the Europeans start to introduce the draft, it's going to cause massive discontent throughout the continent. A lot of these regimes, you look at what's happening in Britain, you look at what's happening in Germany, in France, right? I mean, like, if you've been just following the news about what's happening in Germany, like these seven ADF AFD candidates who've been mysteriously dead. I mean, they mysteriously died for different reasons. So there's a lot of suspicious things going on throughout Europe. So I think these regimes are much more fragile than they appear to be. And I think, like, these elites don't have the mandate to call up a draft. And if they do call up a draft, it's going to cause a cascade of internal rebellion, civil war, civil strife, conflicts, even revolutions.
Is this shortfall in draft recruitment potential, is it related to the massive amounts of immigration that's been flooding into Europe from the global south for the last few decades? Is that why they've let in so many immigrants? Is because they anticipated this coming down the line? And when the time comes, are they just going to recruit all of these immigrants that they brought in to fight their wars for them?
You know, that's a great theory. And, you know, in the United States, some congressmen have introduced this bill where, you know, if you're an illegal immigrant, but you join the military, you'll be on a given citizenship. So there's credibility to this theory. And also, like, if you look at illegal immigration in the United States, most of them are young men in their 20s, which is fighting age material. So I think that's a credible theory. But I don't think we should give too much credit to the elite who run this world. Mm-hmm. I don't think they think that far ahead. I think that right now they're very reactive. I think illegal immigration, mass immigration, was a response to the aging crisis, the COVID crisis. You need to shock up your economy. And so you let in this immigration because that's what gives GDP growth a sort of a short boost. It leads to long-term social problems, but in terms of GDP growth, it solves that problem in the short term. So I think, like, these immigrants will be recruited to join the military, as well as young unemployed men. But again, I don't think the elite has the credibility, authority to ask these men, whether they're immigrants or whether they're native to the country, to go die off in a pointless war. I think you have massive rebellion if the elite do that.
Right. So, I mean, they're effectively trapped between an unstoppable force and an immovable object, then, if they don't have the draft recruitments. I mean, unless they have, like, a bunch of drones that are controlled by remote control, which I highly doubt they do. But regardless, when you talk about the elite, is the elite homogenous, or are there factions involved? Because it appeared that there was a different elite that had more prominence and power from, you know, let's say 2020 to 2023, 2024 or so, like the Davos elite. Now it looks like we have a different elite running things. It's more industrial. It's more, you know, more so aligned with the neocons, you could say. Are there differences between these different groups, or are they homogenous? Hey guys, quick pause from the podcast, but this is something I feel is really important to let you in on. Back in 2020, before I even started this channel, I was looking for an edge, a way to find the big opportunities most investors never even hear about. That's when I found Capitalist Exploits Insider. From day one, it felt like I suddenly had my own team of world-class market pros working for me, digging up trades all over the world, doing the deep research, and handing me ideas that had massive asymmetric upside. Stuff that I would never even think about. Since then, my gains with them have blown past the S&P and the NASDAQ, and it's honestly the single best newsletter I've ever subscribed to. And that's not me blowing smoke. That's for real. I've interviewed their publisher, Chris McIntosh, more times than I can count. In fact, my latest conversation with him is linked in the description box down below if you want to check that out, as well as a pinned comment. And every time, I'm reminded why I've stayed a member for years. Right now, they're offering a special $1,000 discount on the Insider subscription, but it's only for Capital Cosm viewers, so you're only going to get it by clicking the link down below in the description box or the pinned comment. You're not going to find this anywhere else. Click the link, lock it in, and start getting the same game-changing research I've been using since 2020.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. You know, the historian Peter Turchin, he talks about this. He has a concept called elite overproduction. And he argues that societies decline when you have too many elite, because what happens is these elites form the different factions, and they're competing for different, they're competing for a declining slice of the pie. And so that's what we're seeing throughout the Western world. When I mean elite in this context, I'm really talking about the imperial bureaucracy, right? The people who run NATO, the people who run the EU. These are bureaucrats who are just interested in maintaining their nice, cushy jobs. They want to make sure they get a pension. They want to make sure that their children can inherit their position. And I think that's the best explanation for NATO expansion for the past 20 years. You know, Russia would think this is malice. This is that NATO is trying to absorb all these these former Soviet republics in order to encircle Russia. But I think the explanation is much more simple, which is NATO needs to justify its existence. And the best way you can do that is by expanding and expanding and expanding. So when I mean the elite, I really mean these bureaucrats who run Europe, who don't have any imagination. They're just time servers. They really don't know what they're doing. They're reactive. And that's why I think things are heading the way they are, because they don't actually have a strategic plan moving forward. They're just responding to crisis after crisis that they created themselves.
Understood. Well, let's go ahead and shift over to the Middle East. You said that you anticipate an attack on Iran coming imminent. How imminent, and where do we go? What does it look like? Is this going to be another tit for tat round of retaliations and then another break? Or is this really Is this going to be the start of a major war?
So, I mean, the man that you really want to listen to when it comes to the conflict in the Middle East, especially when it involves Iran, is Chidi Parsi. He's at the Quincy Institute, and he really is the foremost expert on these matters. And he's given interviews in which he says he expects a conflict to arise before December of this year. That's really, really quick. And he expects that Israel will resume its aerial bombardment of Iran, which can do very easily because the Syrian state has collapsed. So there's this air corridor from Israel all the way to Iran. And so he expects that to happen very, very quickly. And he expects that once this happens, then Iran will strike much harder at Israel. Iran has shown tremendous restraint so far. You know, the Israelis, the Americans have shown tremendous aggression, but the Iranians have shown tremendous restraint. But I think that in the second round, and Chidi Parsi says this, the Iranians will unleash their full might. And the Iranians have the capacity to destroy Tel Aviv. They really do. So I think that in the second round, the Americans will be much more forceful in the response. I think that this conflict will escalate very rapidly in the Middle East, starting in a couple months. Yeah.
Interesting. And you said this fellow from the Quincy Institute, what's his name?
Chidi Parsi.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
you should definitely interview him. I will spell his name for you, okay?
Yeah.
But you should definitely interview him.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I definitely will. But when it comes to escalation in the Middle East, don't you see you don't see any other off ramps that could stop this thing from going, or is this going to be the thing that pretty much, like you said, once this war happens, because it is in the central corridor of the world, of the world continents, it'll be the trigger for possibly Russia and Europe. And from what I've heard from my other guests along the lines of Martin Armstrong and others, is that they anticipate various pockets of the world to ignite as well into war. Maybe not like on two discerning sides like we had in World War II, but any conflict left unattended over the last decades will see its resolution by military means.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the end of Pax Americana. Right. I mean, before, America was the sole superpower and everyone was afraid to challenge America. They were afraid that if the conflict arose, then America would step in. But as you say, there are lots of unresolved conflicts throughout the world. You have this a conflict between India and Pakistan. You have these conflicts between Azerbaijan and Armenia. You have these conflicts in Eastern Europe, the former Yugoslavia. So we can expect all these conflicts to blow up once America is fully committed in the Middle East.
I see. And then another country that's not being talked about as much as I think it should is Turkey. Turkey has been making some very adversarial claims to Israel. Is Turkey to be taken seriously as an adversary to Israel, or is it many in the Arab world and the Muslim world do not trust Turkey at all? What's your view on it? Is Turkey a legitimate opposition to Israel, or is it more so kind of like a controlled opposition, if you will?
In the Middle East, in terms of military might, I mean, Israel does not have a peer adversary. I mean, if the United States were not in the Middle East, Israel could just go and attack every country. It's really the United States that's really restraining Israel. I mean, I'm not sure if you've been to Israel. I've been to Israel, and it's a very impressive country. It's not a very big country, but the sort of like the innovation that goes on there, the sort of risk-taking, the sort of continuous debate that goes in the country. I mean, it's very impressive. I mean, and Netanyahu, I'm not sure if you saw this, but Netanyahu has basically said that from now on, Israel is going to move towards a Spartan society. I mean, it's going to become a warrior society. And it's unfortunate because before, Israel was this very open, democratic, cosmopolitan nation. But because of what's going to happen in the next couple of years, I think that Israel would become a fortress and a military fortress at that. So whatever civil liberties, whatever openness, whatever cosmopolitanism that Israel had before will evaporate over time. But I mean, at the same time, I mean, the sort of innovation and openness that goes on in Israel is not really matched by any other nation around it, especially not Turkey. Erdogan is a very savvy political calculator. I mean, he like strategically, politically, he's very, very clever. And the way he's clever is that he balances different forces against each other. But I think that he's smart enough to know to never come to full confrontation with Israel. In fact, it's Turkey that supplies Israel with a lot of resources, especially oil, right? So I mean, the talk is great. And I think that Erdogan is trying to play both sides. But at the end of the day, you have to watch what he does. There's no way that Turkey is going to come into military conflict with Israel, and Turkey will continue to support Israel. I mean, you look at what happened in Syria, right? I mean, it would not be like ISIS would not have overtaken Syria without the full support of Turkey. So I think Erdogan is playing all sides, and he's really interested in his own political survival. At the same time, because Turkey is doing that, Turkey is extremely vulnerable. Turkey doesn't have the sort of innovation, the sort of military prowess that Israel has. So if there's a conflict, then we can see that Turkey would basically break down very, very quickly.
Understood. And then you also had this meeting, this summit between the Arabs, the various GCC countries, the Arab countries, and Iran over the attack on Doha. And they filed a joint condemnation of Israel. Of course, you had countries like Syria in there, which has been working closely with Israel. How credible is a group like the GCC? Are they actually, I don't want to say oppositional, because you said there really is no opposition, but are they really adversarial to Israel, or are they just throwing red meat for their population to quell like any potential revolution within their borders?
I think it's a lather. I think like these Gulf states, UAE, Saudi Arabia, they're very concerned that Iran closes Strait of Hormuz. If Iran does that, their economy collapses. These are export, oil-dependent economies. So Iran can also direct its ballistic missiles against Saudi Arabian oil fields, right? I mean, like overnight, Iran could destroy the entire economies of the Gulf states. So the Gulf states are between a rock and a hard place. I mean, it can't piss off Israel because behind Israel is the United States. but it can really piss off Iran as well. So I mean, they're in a really delicate diplomatic mm-hmm. situation.
But here's the other thing too. If Iran does attack in some capacity these Gulf states, I could clearly see the powers that be try to turn this thing into a Sunni versus Shia thing, because then they could exploit it and say, oh, look, Iran's attacking the Sunni states, you see? So that could be another internal conflict that could be ginned up.
Yeah, so I think for the past few years, Iran has shown tremendous diplomatic, strategic, military strength. And the reason why is it understands that its maneuverability is very limited. I mean, it cannot provoke the United States. I mean, it provokes the United States, it loses global opinion. And the United States, I mean, at the end of the day, the United States has nuclear weapons, Iran doesn't. The United States will always have escalation dominance. So that's why we're seeing such a tepid, such a restrained approach by the Iranians. So I don't think that the Iranians will attack the Gulf states. I mean, it loses popular opinion. It loses global opinion if it were to do that. And right now, global opinion is very much on the side of the Iranians. It's the Iranians that have shown tremendous restraint during these past few months. And I think the world appreciates the Iranians for doing that. And also from a military perspective, there's no way that Iran could ever defeat either Israel or the United States in a head-to-head conflict. What Iran needs to do is force a ground invasion. It needs the Americans to come into Fortress Iran. And once Americans are in Fortress Iran, they're stuck there because I'm not sure if you've seen the terrain of Iran, but it's mountainous and it's terrible for logistics. And America doesn't really have the supply chains, doesn't really have the manpower to fight a long-term war in Iran. That's the only way that Iran can ever defeat the United States at the end of the day, if it provokes a ground invasion and if the American forces are trapped in Iran.
Interesting. And where does China fit into all of this? Because China has a lot riding on Iran as well. Will they have some form of, will they contribute anything? Will they have some role to play in a war between Iran and Israel?
Well, I think that's a great question. And I think a lot of people are saying that China cannot afford for Iran to lose. China imports a lot of oil from Iran. China is trying to build trade corridor between it and Iran, because once it has Iran, it's able to access Europe. It's able to access every place, basically. But again, I mean, this is unfortunate. China doesn't really have a geopolitical framework. It doesn't really have a geopolitical strategy. It wants everyone to trade peacefully, but it doesn't really have, it's not willing to commit the military forces. It's not really to be aggressive in trying to achieve its framework. It doesn't really have the intelligence apparatus. It doesn't have the bureaucratic framework. It doesn't really have the military capacity to dominate and outside its territory. So I think that throughout this conflict, China will remain the peacekeeper. It will try to bring the opposing parties to the negotiating table and try to achieve a peaceful settlement as soon as possible. But China will never, ever commit military forces in the conflict.
Understood. Well, Professor, it's been a very fascinating interview. Anything else that you'd like to talk about before we wrap things up here?
Yeah, so one thing that's really important for your viewers to understand is the eschatological element to what's happening in the Middle East. So, you know, we often use a geopolitical or economic framework to interpret events in the Middle East. But one thing that we don't do enough is talk about the religious elements. There are crazy religious elements at work in the Middle East. You have Netanyahu is supported by the extreme religious right, and they want to bring about the end times. They want to bring about the end of the world. And I think that's why you're seeing so much tragedy in Gaza. And that's why I think that Israel is going to attack Iran. They're trying to bring about biblical prophecy. And that's what drives these people. And if that's the case, then this thing can only culminate in tragedy. And I think it's really important for us to appreciate the eschatological element of what's happening in the Middle East. Otherwise, it's going to be very confusing for people what's going to happen. I think you know, I'm not sure if you looked at the Red Heifer case where the Israelis have imported red heifers. Why would you do that? Well, according to a prophecy, you need red heifers to be sacrificed in order to sanctify the third temple. But to build a third temple, you would need to destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque. So if that were to happen, you can see the entire Muslim world, all 1 billion Muslims around the world, they would be up in arms. And I think when that happens, everyone's going to be like completely shocked. But unless you understand the religious eschatological elements to this conflict, then nothing makes sense.
Yeah. And for those who may not know, the Al-Aqsa Mosque is the third most relevant holy site in Islam. So right. If that happens, that could be, I mean, that would unify Muslims all over the world.
It would. It would. And that's why these regimes in the Gulf states and Turkey are so vulnerable right now, because they know it's what Israel is going to do. And they know it's going to aggravate the their populations. Many millions of Muslims will have no choice but to go to war against Israel because of this insult to their religion. So I don't think these Arab elites have much maneuverability in this sort of situation.
No. And it does appear that they are just using their words to throw out red meat and to quell any potential outburst of revolutions within their ranks and rebellion and things like that. Go ahead.
Look. I mean, I hate to emphasize this, but what's crazy about the world right now is that it's been captured by small groups of fanatical religious zealots. Okay, there's no other way to put it. You have these zealots in Israel, but you also have these Christian Zionists in the United States who also want to push for an American Civil War, also push for a Third World War. They're also pushing for the end of the world. But you also have zealots in the Orthodox tradition, in the Catholic tradition. So, and the elite, the bureaucratic elite, they're kind of stuck where they are because they don't have any ideas. They don't know how to respond to these crises. And so that's the world we live in right now. And that's why we're heading into a series of crises over the next couple of years.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely going to be messy. We are heading into a series of crises, and what happens on the other side? It looks like we are heading from one world order to a new world order or a different world order. And the transition is going to be very, very messy in the process. So, Professor, thank you so much for coming on, my friend. I highly recommend people check out your Predictive History YouTube channel. I'll have a link down below.
Great. Thank you.
I discovered one of your videos a couple of weeks ago, and it just led me down a rabbit hole. I just watched like 5 or 6 of them like in one sitting.
Okay, that's a lot.
Yeah. Well, the clips, not like the 2-hour lecture.
They're hour long lectures.
Yeah. Yeah. But I'll send the link to both the clips page as well as the main page as well. So, Professor, anything else you'd like to talk about? Anything else that you'd like to plug or mention before we sign off?
I mean, be safe out there, guys. I mean, it's gonna be tough, but be safe out there.
Understood. All right, guys. Well, if you enjoyed this podcast, drop us a like and comment. Go, Professor Jang, go in the comment section. If you agreed or disagreed, let me know what you do agreed or disagreed on. Because I do in fact read the comments. So drop me your thoughts down below. I will respond to a small handful of comments. I can't get to all of them, but that's why you should drop a comment. You not only get my attention, you also give me feedback and let me know how I can maneuver and change things in these shows. So subscribe to the channel as well. And by liking, subscribing, commenting, engaging with the content, doing all the YouTube stuff, you help us out in pushing this video and this channel in the algorithm. So it may not seem like much, but a little bit does go a long way, and it's free. And then finally, check us out on Substack at capitalcosm.substack.com to get all my content early, ad-free, and for those that warrant it, uncensored. You also get a chance to ask my guests questions and make guest recommendations down the line. So with all that said, thanks for watching, guys. I'll catch you later.